5 p.m. on Friday. Time for American Hit Radio on WHPC 90.3 FM.
Your double happy hour.
That's right. Happy, happy hour, everybody. Friday at 5 p.m. doesn't get much better than that.
Mm.
And you get to spend an hour with us on the radio, so I hope that makes it even that much more exciting. This actually is kind of fun and interesting because we have been playing Rolling Stones music for this hour of our show every Friday for about about a full year now. This is show number 46, and we are really coming to the end of our run. This is the second to last show we will be doing on the Rolling Stones. And it seems pretty remarkable to have been... it's funny how quickly the end comes.
You're getting sad.
For example, the 8 years that passed, say, between Satisfaction and Angie, I think those songs were about 8 years apart. It probably took us about 32 shows to cover those 8 years. With so much that was happening with the band and with their history. Here, we are covering 15 years and 2 shows.
Yikes.
Last week, we covered 7 years, which was the void before A Bigger Bang came out.
As time passes, it seems to pass more quickly. Well, here's your proof.
Well, right. It's really because a whole lot less is happening.
I'm just kidding.
8 years had passed since Bridges to Babylon, when they finally released A Bigger Bang in 2005. And I've always confused those two albums in my head, never really quite getting it. Why? Until just today, as I'm writing the two titles, I'm like, what's with this B alliteration? Bigger Bang, Bridges to Babylon. Of course I'm confusing these albums. Anyway, there was obviously 8 years is such a long time to wait for a collection of new material. It's almost ridiculous. But the Stones didn't care. I mean, they were doing just fine, releasing live album souvenirs and going on their gigantic tours, making more money than they ever had before. Writing new music was really secondary now to their existence. They just maybe wanted to, you know, basically do it to see if they still could, but it was no longer their reason for existing. The tours were. So the album was almost like a little bonus. What's really crazy is that 8-album span was the longest by far that the Rolling Stones had ever waited between releasing new material. But that album came out in 2005, and now it's 2014, and we haven't seen an album since then either.
Hmm.
So it's probably going to be a minimum of 10 years before they put out another album of new material. And that is a big if. It might not happen. It's very possible that it's just not likely to happen.
It might be over.
Well, A Bigger Bang, as I said, came out in 2005. It was their 24th studio album. Boy, we came a long way. And we're just going to play a couple of tracks from the record with some information as we move along. So let's just jump right in with the opening track from A Bigger Bang. Boy, almost 10 years old already. Here's the opening track entitled Rough Justice.
Oh, like a little grifter. You're acting way too smart. Your face a little bit flushed for a walk in the park. And you're clutching your phone as you walk in the door. And your smile's got a twist. You're looking so hardcore. If you're something to say, don't be too direct. 'Cause I feel a little fragile. Don't hit the nail on the head. Well, I said, oh, baby, baby, let me down real slow. Oh, no, no, no. Well, I said, oh, baby, baby, let me down real slow. No, 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 no. There's a swish in your step. There's a gleam in your eye. Are you coloring your hair with some new kind of dye? But the first one to blink is the first one to fall.
That's the opening pair of tracks from the last studio release from the Rolling Stones, A Bigger Bang. We heard Rough Justice and Let Me Down Slow. What's appealing about these songs is that they're so straightforward.
Yeah, it sounds like the dynamic duos back to work together.
Yeah, that really is the case. They really are working as a team here. Like we've been reading a lot of excerpts from Keith's book, and you just get this sense of that for the past 20 years, the two of them were just really at odds with one another almost every turn, starting with Mick's solo career up until about this point. And it just seems like they've more or less got over it. I mean, the other thing, it sounds like they're also working together in terms of style.
Yes.
They sound like a regular rock and roll band, you know, stripped down, a nice tight outfit. No gimmicks, no trendy stylistic shifts, no trying to force themselves, you know, into a box that's unusual. Here's Keith talking about the session. Keith talking about the sessions from his book Life, in his own words. Maybe because it was a relaxing year for Mick, the following year after that, 2004, was the best year I'd spent with him in God knows how long. He'd become a lot looser. I don't know why. Maybe it's just growing up and realizing that this is really what you've got. I think a lot of it has to do with what happened with Charlie. I'd gone to Mick's house in France in 2004 to start writing together for a new record, the first in 8 years, which would become a bigger bang. Mick and I were sitting together, and the first or second day I got there with acoustic guitars, just trying to start some songs. And Mick said, "Oh dear, Charlie's got cancer." There was a pregnant pause, like, what do we do? It was as big a shock to me as any, because he was saying, do we put this on hold and wait for Charlie to see what happens? And I thought for a minute, and I said, no, let's start. We're starting to write songs, so we don't need Charlie right now. And Charlie would be very annoyed if we stopped just because he was incapacitated for the moment. It wouldn't be good for Charlie, and we've got some songs to write. Let's write a few. We'll send Charlie the tapes so we can have a listen to where we're at. And that's the way we did it. So more or less gave them more or less common cause, common concern, bringing the band together. Well, the first track that we played, the opening track, Rough Justice, was a B-side, or I guess the other A-side, because how CDs work these days,
yeah,
you know,
that's
basically,
true.
Of the first single released by the band for this album. The second single was this track right here. It's entitled Rain Fall Down.
Filthy block of flats, trash was on the floor, a snake was in my nose, hinges off the doors. She took me in her room, I was spick and span, fixed me up a drink, turned down all the lamps. And the rain Bill the Beans, yeah.
Another thing you might be noticing is that the arrangements on these songs are relatively sparse, straightforward, you know, generally a four-piece rock band, sometimes five. Ronnie Wood was absent from a lot of the sessions for one reason or another. He just didn't.
Why?
Yeah, he only played on about maybe a little bit more than half of the album. So, and it doesn't tell me why. Just basically that he wasn't around. So it kind of tightened things up a little bit for whatever reason. And no offense to Ronnie, because I like the way he plays, but I think, you know, a lot of critics seem to like the record as it was. A lot of critics were coming out calling it the, literally, as I'm reading it here, the best Rolling Stones album in years, which is kind of funny because it's the only Rolling Stones album in years. You know, it's kind of self-explanatory. Well, here's the track that was the lead-off single. This is the, I guess you could say, the A side of that first single that was coming out to promote the album. This is called Streets of Love.
You're awful bright, you're awful smart. I must admit, you broke my heart. The awful truth, it's really sad. I must admit, I was awful bad. While lovers laugh and music plays, I stumble by and I hide my pain. The lamps are lit, the moon is gone. I think I cross the Rubicon. And cars, a couple watch me from above. A band just played the wedding march in the corner store. Men's broken hearts and a woman ass there for a dance. Oh, it's free of charge. Just one more. Awful sad, I must admit, I was awful.
Yeah.
hear a preacher on the corner ranting like a crazy man. He says that troubles are coming. I can read it like the back of my hand. I see love, I see misery. Jim and side by side on the stage. In the wind, some awful melody. I can read it like the back of my hand.
There you hear the lead-off single from the album first, Streets of Love, and then a track reminiscent of, say, 68-era Rolling Stones.
Very cool.
Back of My Hand, right there with the original blues. Now, the album sold great when it came out. It went platinum right away in the U.S. and, you know, Germany and Japan was selling like hotcakes. The singles, though, did almost nothing. Singles, like I'm just, there was zero interest in the Rolling Stones singles at this point. I can't help but wonder if they shot themselves in the foot with the previous years of releasing all of those singles with the various mixes that was driving me crazy. Because at this point, even I stopped buying the extra releases. I know they're out there somewhere, but I'm not going there. I don't want to even talk about it right now. Or else I might find myself getting, you know.
You're going to reignite your
starting to
neurosis.
Think about it. Exactly. Now, if you're wondering just how big the Stones had gotten, or, you know, really were, as far as, like, forget the band, they were always famous and huge as a band. But at this point in time, in February 2006, that's the year that they played the halftime show for Super Bowl 40 in Detroit, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
After that, they went on tour for the Bigger Bang Tour. They raked in $162 million for the one tour that they did. For the Bigger Bang, for this album.
That's incredible.
$162 million for the one tour. It was that they broke their own world record on that one. And then on February 18th of the following year, 2006, they ended up going to Rio, Copacabana Beach, where they actually played on the beach to 1.5 million people.
Whoa.
One show.
That must have been pandemonium.
That's frightening. Totally scary.
Yeah, I've been to Copacabana and... it's not that. How could they? I don't know how they could fit that many people.
It's insane. Keith talks about it a little bit here. Again, excerpt from the book Life. They built a bridge over the Copacabana Road that went right down to the stage on the beach from our hotel, just for us to get there.
I'd have to.
When I look at the video of that show, I realize that I was concentrating like mad. I mean, grim. What had to be right was the sound, pal. Didn't matter about the rest. I'd turned into a bit of a nursemaid, just making sure everything was going right. And understandably so, because we were playing to a million people, 1.5 million, actually. And half of them were in another bay around the corner. So I was wondering if it was projecting that far or if it ended up in a muddle somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I'm sure it probably did.
Since we could only see a quarter of the audience, they had screens set up for 2 miles.
Relays.
Yeah, that might have been the triumphant exit, apart from a couple of shows in Japan, to a long career slinging the hash, because pretty soon after that, I fell off my branch. We'll get to that in a short bit, but let's hear a track which is actually the third and final single that was extracted from the album A Bigger Bang. This track is called Biggest Mistake.
So smart, she's a hell of a catch. I was drinking in love, gulping it down, drifting for months on a billowing cloud. After a while, I stopped to rebel. I'm back in the past and I'm raising up hell. But I think I've just made the biggest mistake of my life. The harmony is perfect, it rang loud and clear. But then very slowly, my nerves start to freeze. The little things, baby, that's what they say. I acted impatient, acted unkind. I took her for granted, I played with her mind. She didn't deserve it, but it was too late. I walked out the door and left her to her. Just made the biggest mistake of my life. And I think I just made
third and final single extracted from the album A Bigger Bang. That's called Biggest Mistake. While I was playing, I think I discovered the reason why Ronnie Wood was not present on most of the sessions. It was around this time when he was going in and out of various rehabilitation programs for substance abuse and alcohol. And I'm sure that that kept him away a great deal of the time. He stayed close with the band, though, very good friends. In fact, he played a big role in what was happening with Keith when he fell out of the tree. In fact, he was vacationing with Ronnie Wood and Josephine, his partner, and Patty, Keith's own wife. Right. Here's the way the story goes, as Keith tells it. The four of us had flown to Fiji and were staying on a private island. We'd gone for a picnic on a beach. Ronnie and I went for a swim while Josephine and Patty were organizing lunch. There was a hammock, and I think Ronnie had the hammock. He got in quick. And we were just drying off after a swim. And there was this tree. Forget any palm tree. This was some gnarled low tree that was basically a horizontal branch. It was obvious that people had sat there before because the bark was worn away. And it was about, I guess, 7 feet up. So I'm just sitting there on the branch, waiting for lunch and drying off. And they said, lunch is ready. And there was another branch in front of me, and I thought, I'll just grab a hold of that and drop gently to the ground. But I forgot that my hands were still wet, and there was sand and everything on them. And as I grabbed this branch, the grip didn't take. So I landed hard on my heels, and my head went back and hit the trunk of the tree.
Ouch.
Hard. And that was it. It didn't bother me at the time. Are you all right, darling? Yeah, fine. Don't do that again. As he says. Now, he goes, 2 days later, I was still feeling fine, and we went out in this boat. The water was like a mirror until we got out into the sea a little, and these huge Pacific swells started coming in. Josephine was at the front, and she said, oh, look at this. So I went up to the bow, and a swell came in, and I fell back down, just onto the seat. And suddenly, something went.
Oh,
a blinding headache came on. We've got to turn around now, I said. Still, I thought that was that. But this headache got worse and worse.
Oh, dear.
I found out later that I was lucky that the second jolt happened because the first one had cracked my skull.
Oh,
and that could have gone on for months and months before being discovered or before killing me. It could have kept on bleeding under the skull.
Whoa.
But the second blow made it obvious. That night I took a couple of aspirin for the headache, which is the wrong thing to do because aspirin thins the blood.
Yeah.
The things you learn when you're killing yourself. And apparently in my sleep, I had two seizures.
I guess it's a good thing his wife noticed.
So he obviously had to go, in for surgery. And a month after that, I spent a month in a wee Victorian boarding house in Auckland. And all my family came out, bless their hats. And I had messages from Jerry Lee Lewis, from Willie Nelson, too. Jerry Lee sent me a signed 45 of Great Balls of Fire, first pressing.
Aww.
Goes on the wall. Bill Clinton sent me a note, get well soon, my dear friend. The opening line of my letter from Tony Blair was, dear Keith, you've always been one of my heroes. England's in the hand of somebody who I'm a hero of? It's frightening. I've even got one from the mayor of Toronto. It gave me an interesting preview of my obituaries, the general flavor of what's to come. Jay Leno said, why can't we make planes like we make Keith? And Robin Williams said, you can bruise them, you can't break them. I got a few good lines out of knocking myself on the head, added to all the other knocks. What was amazing to me was what the press dreamed up. Because it's Fiji, it must be a palm tree I fell out of. And I had to be 40 feet off the ground going for a coconut.
Yeah, of course.
And then jet skis came into the story, which are things I really dislike intensely because they're noisy and stupid and disruptive to the reefs. Anyway, there's the truth of it, in the words of Keith. Here's one more track from A Bigger Bang. This is a bit of a rocker called Oh No, Not You Again. Caucus Rocker off of the album A Bigger Bang by the Rolling Stones. It's an interesting, because they did something here that actually did cause a bit of a rift between Mick and Keith. So, and surprisingly, it was Keith who took the more conservative role, at least from a social perspective. Mick wrote a song that was bluntly political, where he was calling out the conservatives, especially the young conservative movement, for being hypocrites, fairly blunt lyrically. And it was Keith who said, we should maybe keep this record, this song off of the record. It was, don't forget, it was around this time when the Dixie Chicks had made their comments about George Bush, and the ramifications on their career was quite obvious. They definitely had problems, especially touring in the South in America, where there was all sorts of problems.
Mick didn't
problems.
Care.
But Mick wasn't worried about it at all. But the way that Keith looked at it is like, we're going to have this whole storm in a teacup. It's pointless. Why do it? But it turns out that they did release it. And you know what's funny? It's one of the tracks that got the most airplay off of the album. I always say that, you know, it must be tough sometimes to be a hard right conservative and a rock and roll fan, because so much rock and roll comes from the left. Here's a pretty decent example of that. From the album A Bigger Bang, this track is called Sweet Neocon. All right, there it is. Of course, Sweet Neo Khan. You're listening to the How Music Changed version of the American Hit Radio program. Heidi and I do this every Wednesday and Friday. We are really just about virtually at the end of our shows dedicated to the Rolling Stones. This is show number 46 in our series. The last show, number 47, will be next week. If you want to hear us wrap it up, it'll be a bit of an overview, pretty much of everything that we've covered up to this point. And then we will move on to a brand new topic. We go all the way back before we come back to something
That's
relatively
right.
contemporary.
Back to the past instead of back to the future.
The point of this show is that we do mean to cover as much history as possible. And we're going to be covering the father of country music, Jimmie Rodgers, for a couple of shows. So
that's going to be fun.
Hope you can stick with us. Hope to make it fun for you. And we'll even try to get you to appreciate yodeling a little bit for that show, if we could. Now, talking about the Stones here, I mean, I read that figure of 168 million earlier. It's 162 million, excuse me, for the American tour. Pretty stunning, if you know, obviously, a huge amount of money.
I'd take half of it.
Look at this. After that was done, they went on the European leg of the tour, which was slightly delayed because of Keith's incident. When he had fallen from the tree, but they still managed to play the most of the shows that were on that tour. They then returned to North America for more concerts in September of 2006, and then went back to Europe again in 2007.
Holy smokes!
By November, the tour had been declared the highest grossing tour of all time, earning $437 million.
Whoa.
That North American leg brought in the third highest receipts ever, about $138 million.
Man, they must have had the investors clamoring.
Could you imagine? Then on March 24th of 2007, they announced yet another tour of Europe called the Bigger Bang 2000.
Crazy.
How can you stop? You know, I mean, my God, you're a money machine at this point.
Well, I guess you got to make it while the getting's good, you know?
Right. They released a 4-DVD set. Again, their second time they had done that. Remember the first one was that exclusive debacle that they had done with the one retailer. This time they didn't go that route. It was called The Biggest Bang, 7 hours of the Stones Live, four different shows.
Oh, my God.
At the conclusion of the tour, when it was all done, it was announced that the Rolling Stones had made $558 million.
Whoa.
On the tour.
I hope they paid their taxes.
They are now in the Guinness Book of World Records. For that, if you could imagine. Pretty incredible. So you might have been saying at some point in time, oh no, not you again, when the Stones were rolling around.
Totally.
Here is one more track toward, as you come near the end of the album, A Bigger Bang. This is called Look What the Cat Dragged In.
Round about nine.
Well, we wrapped up another hour, and we are right now pretty much up to date with our coverage of the Rolling Stones. You can join us next week as we do a recap, thankfully most of it provided by Martin Scorsese, and that will be our last program dedicated to the Rolling Stones. Well, if you've been paying attention for the past five or six albums, you'll notice that it became sort of traditional for the Rolling Stones to end their studio albums with a track written by Keith Richards. No difference here either. So we'll leave you with the closing track from the album, a Keith tune called Infamy. See you next week, everyone. Have a great weekend.
Sayonara.